Ready? I will call the Community Development Committee meeting to order for Monday, July 22nd. State who's here, Rick Bagerly.
Vicki Davis.
Sean Meskey.
Kathy Schwantes.
Brian Grammons.
Aaron Backman, EDC.
Dave Ramstead.
All right, then we have Cory Bacchus, the mayor, and Shelby in the audience. Public comment, anyone here for public comment? I believe so. Item three, natural gas line extension. Aaron, you're going to take this?
Yes, and then I'm going to have a couple of handouts. One is of the industrial park, and then the second one, in looking at the packet, the map was a little bit dark, and so I thought I would provide something a little bit lighter so that you could see what's being discussed. And in just general terms, there's enough of that handout, not enough on this one, but if you can share, that would be great.
Does someone need this or no?
All right, so if you look at this page, you'll just in general terms see the Wilmer Industrial Park, first, second editions, the third edition, which covers part of the old airport. The first and second edition covers Relco, Mills Auto Warehouse, and then on the southern end, Genio. And then the fourth edition is on the west side, or to the west of County Road 5. And so you can kind of see that area, which was the area that pertained to the shovel-ready certification in 2016. And within that context, you can see the lots that have been sold within the fourth edition. And in the upper portion off of 3rd Avenue, the two lots in the northeast are pertaining to Dooley's Petroleum, their new corporate headquarters and maintenance facility. The northwest corner of that block is where Corey has his business. In the southwest portion, you'll see south of Wilmer Avenue where Magnum has an LTL, less than full load facility. RFR refers to first right of refusal, so there are several lots that are governed by that. So for example, under the third edition, where you see that the largest lot, which is 30 acres, that RFR pertains to Genio Turkey Store. They have the first right on that, and they're about halfway through that particular agreement with the city. The RFR to the west, that is with Magnum. They have the first right of refusal on the lot there. And then there's a lot that's near Dooley's. The other one shows kind of the route, and the green intermittent lines pertain to natural gas lines that exist today. And then the orange line pertains to what is being proposed. So if you look at the third edition, there is a line that comes down from Highway 12, follows along past the Relco and so forth, and comes down to 28th, down 28th, down to Trot. Also, there is an existing 2-inch line that goes east and west from CR5 on the east side, and then it goes over to Magnum. So basically, there is no natural gas in the northern two-thirds of the fourth edition. So that gives you just a little bit of background on it. The EDC is respectfully requesting that the Community Development Committee consider and recommend to the City Council that they partner with Bacchus Technology to fund a 2,450-foot extension of a natural gas pipeline from the intersection of Trot and 28th to near the intersection of 32nd and 3rd Avenue Southwest. This would be a 4-inch natural gas line, and it would follow on the south side of Trot and then turn 90 degrees and go on the east side of 32nd. Bacchus Technology is a communications-related company. It was the second business located in the fourth edition. In 2016, Bacchus purchased one lot in the northwest corner of the certified site. In early 2017, the company completed its facility west of Dooley's Petroleum. And a while back, as Technologies was able to hook up to municipal water, sewer, and electricity, CenterPoint Energy, the local gas supplier, had not extended service to this portion of the industrial park. A subsequent quote of over $25,000 to get natural gas service was not cost-effective and dissuaded Corey from doing so. As a stopgap measure, Bacchus utilized a propane tank and furnace last winter. Ideally, they want to have natural gas. CenterPoint Energy is willing to extend a 4-inch line nearly half a mile to the Bacchus building at a cost of $14,324. It would take a number of years for Bacchus to get a return on this investment. They are asking if the cost of the line extension can be shared between the city and the business. If you look at the number of feet, they represent about 12% of the total distance. That would equate to a cost of $1,719 of the cost. Bacchus is willing to pay $4,000 or 28% of the cost if the city is willing to pick up the difference. I would also add, when you're dealing with a natural gas provider, because they are dealing with ratepayers, there are certain rules. So I dealt with a natural gas line extension when I was working for the city of Windham in Southwest State, and we actually had a line extension. If you are a major user, such as Genio or Fast Global Solutions or Toro, you can basically get the cost of that natural gas line almost for nothing. But if you are a little guy, you get hammered. Because the way they structure it is, if you have a large load, they can justify to ratepayers that they will put it in for a nominal. So Fast Global Solutions was able to get their 6-inch line coming in at $3,000. But for a little lab that I was dealing with that would do testing, they were going to charge $25,000. That's the way the cookie crumbles when you're dealing with natural gas. That's a big lift for a small company. So that's just a little bit of background here. In 2016, the city of Willmar and EDC partnered in pursuing shovel-ready certification for the fourth edition. And the EDC's application was successful, in this, and we had done various things in terms of an ALTA survey, geotechnical soil borings, phase one environmental, all that information. And that information has been helpful a number of times when we've worked with both businesses, existing businesses, as well as prospects. In fact, just on Friday, I was dealing with a prospect in the Twin Cities, and that information would be helpful for them. And so we were successful in that process. In June of that year, we were able to have a shovel-ready certified site. That does not mean that there will not be additional improvements in the industrial park that will be needed from time to time. I think that this extension of the natural gas line will be a positive development. I think having natural gas going into the majority of the lots in the fourth edition is a positive development. There are 25 lots that exist in the fourth edition. This one line will serve 14 of them. That's a good thing. I think it will also enhance recruiting efforts, and it's being done on a cost-effective basis because there's somebody at the end of the line. So that just gives you a little bit of background of what we're talking about. Again, the proposed line is on the orange here. So any questions on this? I should also add, we did look at the possibility of a 6-inch line because that would provide a significant capacity. There's two problems. One is that where they're hooking up is only a 4-inch line. So it's kind of hard to go from 4 to 6. And the second problem is cost. They can do a 6-inch line, but their quote to us is $91,000. So if Corey wants to hook up at that point, that's a big lift. There's no way he's going to look at $91,000 to get natural gas. I don't care how you structure it. 4-inch line is or will allow us to have natural gas service to the majority of the lots. So that's stand for any questions.
So one thing that complicates this is that Dooley's never hooked up to natural gas since they sell propane.
Right. So this would have been avoided if Dooley's Petroleum would have hooked up to natural gas. They have a big enough facility that that would justify it, but they are a competitor, or they could view CenterPoint as a competitor, and they absolutely refused to hook up, and so they went with alternative energy options.
And it's, you know, it's unfortunate that the city has to pay some of these fees, but in reality, whoever builds, we can just charge them a tapping fee, so we should get our money back.
Right. I mean, I think there are ways to adjust the price. If somebody's looking at the middle block, which was looked at seriously a couple months ago, I think we can adjust the price of the lots or have a tapping fee. I think there's ways to recover the $10,000. Right now, from a sources and uses, I would propose that it would be utilized from the Wilmer Industrial Park Fund, which currently has a balance of $1.6
million. It's got a deduction coming up.
Okay, so, well, over a million.
Other question? Kathy?
It's my understanding that Bacchus does not need a 4-inch line, and so we would be overbuilding to accommodate others.
Right. Corey wouldn't need to have a 4-inch line. I think he could survive on a 1 or 2-inch line. But if we're going to have other users along that way, whether it's on the east side or west side of 32nd, it makes sense to have enough capacity to accommodate this.
Yeah, I called CenterPoint today and they said this is fine for the 14 lots.
Okay. Yeah, if someone big comes out, they'll probably need a 6-inch line, have to be parallel or something.
Right. I mean, there was a discussion, I think, with Perry, who was with CenterPoint, and I asked him, I said, well, if the logistics company would have come, would you have extended a 6-inch line? And yes, they would have extended a 6-inch line from 28th at a nominal cost. But once again, the little guy gets hammered. And so my view is this is a twofer. We're not only extending natural gas options for the majority of the lots in the fourth edition, but we're helping a smaller business that's in the industrial park.
And the majority of types of businesses, the exception being where they have to run in a new line.
Yeah. Sean?
All of it makes sense, and thank you for the presentation. If I look at the overall picture of this, is the 2-inch line, I know it's not what we're talking about, is the 2-inch line coming down here adequate to serve all of the lots within its reach?
I would say no.
Perry's told me that that 2-inch line only services the, I'm sorry, but yep, that's only going to service them. And the 4-inch line would service along the way, but the cost of this, the $10,000, $10,324, is for the cost of a 2-inch line. But they're willing to put in a 4-inch line knowing that they're going to come across and possibly get some more revenue.
Well, you'd say, well, going from 2 to 4 inches doesn't seem that big of a, but when you're talking about diameters, that's a lot more capacity.
This is what I think. Is that does sound like it's a lot more, and I'm curious. I mean, if we're going to have shovel ready, which I think is great, do you think it's a draw to be able to have natural gas service that they can just tap right into? Because if you do, I don't want to talk out of turn, and I know that there's an agreement here, but if that 4-inch line were to drop down to be able to service the rest of the lots as it pertains as you go south, is there a dollar figure attached to that? Because if we're going to do this, because I would assume otherwise, when there's another person coming in here, I'm going to see you sit across the table again talking about getting gas in the lines here. Because
right.
I mean, how much would a price be to drop this down to that 2-inch line so I have the whole industrial park service?
They would charge us a lot more money, even though distance-wise it's not much more. But if there's not an end user at the end of that,
okay,
they're going to charge us a lot more.
All right.
And then if you're along the way to have a hookup, you're going to be typically charged about $1,500 to $2,000 to do the hookup.
Okay.
Let's say you're in the lot south of Corey. If somebody's going to be hooked up south of there, I would not be surprised if CenterPoint would say, okay, that's going to cost you $1,800 or whatever it is. You'd look at that and say, well, you know, how do you come up with these numbers? But that's how they calculate things. And
okay,
it really depends, again, on the volume that they're going to utilize. If it's a food processing company or if it's a major warehouse, they're going to give that major user a discount. And if it's the little guy, they are going to hammer in, that person. And it doesn't sound fair, but that's the way the system works.
Vicki, do you have any questions?
No, just.
Okay. Well, I think it's a good deal. So. You need a motion to approve or deny?
I would move that we approve the development of this 4-inch line as proposed.
And with the cost of $10,000 or whatever for the city. And you approve?
Second.
Second. Okay. Further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? It carries.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, sir.
Yeah. Thank you all very much.
I want you to stay warm this winter.
Have a good night.
See ya. Item 4, the National Flood Plain Insurance Program. We've been at it for a month now.
Yep.
So it's either move on or...
Yep. Thank you very much, Chair Fagerly, for bringing us to the committee. It has. It's been kind of going around. It's kind of festering. So I'm glad you got it off the off its blocks. In your packet, you had a full email composite of all the emails that have been exchanged and the questions and answers. I actually invited Sean Christensen to tonight's meeting to make sure that he could say his piece. I guess he chose not to be here tonight, but staff is recommending a motion to forward the FEMA enrollment application, the floodplain ordinance, and resolution to participate in the National Flood Insurance Program to the Planning Commission first for a public hearing on August 7th, and then to City Council on August 19th, where staff will recommend a motion to introduce the resolution and ordinance for a public hearing at the City Council's September 2nd meeting. Nothing has changed since the first time you've reviewed it. And really, I think what the key point to adopting or participating in the National Flood Insurance Program is one that allows people that aren't in the floodplain to get NFIP-backed flood insurance for rain and storm sewer disasters, because it's conspicuously missing from home insurance policies. And secondly, if we do have a national sort of disaster, that the feds won't hem and haw about providing us with low interest loans and grants and other aid because we're not participating in their National Flood Insurance Program. I think those are the two real key points, because there's really just a handful of homes that are in the floodplain, and from looking at it and re-looking at it, it looks like they followed the flood regulations anyway, because the flood line literally curves around each home and comes to a little point in between each of them. So they've obviously built them up out of the flood zone, and I can't speak to whether or not they did their mechanicals and got them above the base flood elevation or not, but those are really just some of the things that our building official will be required to check while they're doing their new home construction plan reviews. And it's pretty minimal work, and then submitting their existing building officials report to FEMA for the annual report, which is no effort at all. So from our departmental perspective, it's a pretty minimal effort, and I think there's a lot to be gained with people being able to have access to NFIP backed flood insurance. And with that, I close for questions.
So what's the estimate that it's going to cost the city to join them? Do we have to do
surveying
or something?
Well, if the council decided that they wanted to actually verify some of these flood lines, there would be a cost in maybe doing some spot surveys across the city just to do some verification. I know in my former jurisdiction we did that, but we did it at the time that our maps were being revised, and so we could actually interact with FEMA and get some things corrected as they were creating them. For us to do it now, we wouldn't be able to go to FEMA and get them corrected anyway. Individual homeowners can have surveys done on their properties and then receive a LOMA or a LOMAR. Typically, it's a LOMA because they don't actually want to. The LOMAR is a revision of the map. They don't like to do that. So they like to just do an amendment, and then you just record it at the recorder's office, and it shows that you're out.
So how often do they update the flood maps? Every 5 years or 10 years?
Well, you know, it's supposed to be about every 10, but realistically, the last map was from the 70s. I mean, it was very old. And same thing with the Valley Cities. It was very old. I mean, it's an expensive thing to do, even with LIDAR, with the satellite-based survey systems. Because even if you do LIDAR, you still have to have boots on the ground to do some verification and tweak the system. So
that's our cost, then.
I honestly don't think it's going to be revised again in our lifetimes. I don't. Okay. Yeah.
Sean?
Is there a cost to the homeowner that has their map redone?
Yes. They would have to hire a surveyor, probably, you know, from one of the local engineering firms. That individual would survey their property. They'd fill out the forms, submit them, answer questions from FEMA. They'd be their representative, basically. So,
any idea of a cost associated with that? Because I'm trying to think of the worst case scenario is it's going to be that cost, and then I'm going to ask you the follow-up of, it says it's, we talked about before, is nominal, but do we have any kind of an idea? I know it's going to depend on who your insurance provider is, of what that mandatory insurance will be for one holding a mortgage that's in that.
I think the insurance is about a little under $1,000 a year.
Okay.
I think getting the LOMA application done with the survey and everything, I've heard that's roughly $2,000 to $3,000.
Okay.
So
we could be costing
a few homes.
There's going to be very few, but that could be three.
Yes, if they wanted to get out of the, if they wanted to get their property
out
or redress their property, which would also be a cost.
Sure.
Then they would have to invest a little bit to get out.
Okay. Thank you.
Yep.
Kathy, question.
What is different with the information we're getting tonight than what we've received in the past?
Virtually nothing except for the additional the vetting and the emails. Otherwise, I did not change anything. There was nothing in terms of editing the ordinance or editing the resolution. It was all comments primarily about the negativity of adopting it and the consequences and things like that. So, and that's what my responses addressed.
Thank you.
Yep.
Vicki?
I see that Sean said it would add federal regulations to standard building codes. What would that be?
You know, I think he's talking about just the federal floodplain regulations, which requires you to floodproof your home if you're in the floodplain. Okay. And that layer is you need to have your finished living area and the bottom of your trusses 1 foot above base flood elevation. You also need to have your mechanical systems, your electrical panel, all that needs to be out of flood elevation. And then if you have a crawl space, there's some requirements with it being a wash through so that waters don't get trapped under there and you don't get mildew and molds. It can wash in and wash out. Those are just a few other things. But those are very easy, kind of almost cursory, almost part of the process of the review. So that's not going to add anything to Tom's or Jason's jobs, the building official or the building inspector's jobs.
Sean?
Brian, I know we talked a little bit on it last time, but you're not on the email official list with a position. What are your thoughts on this ordinance?
Well, if you want to talk about the maps not being as accurate as they possibly be, that's true. If you want to expend the funds, and get out of it, prove you're out of it, and that's a 3-year payback, which is fantastic for most people that are going to be in that situation. They don't have to, they're not required to spend the money, either to get out or to find themselves in. It's just what do they want? as far as the construction aspect of it, very true. It doesn't add, there's regulations, but it doesn't add onerous regulations. What they're basically going to say is, when the water comes up, we ain't paying for your furnace. We're not paying for, you know, this stuff. You have to get it out of there. Now, you see some people just disconnect them when the water starts rising and get them to dry land. And then I've seen people, you know, $300,000 house with a walkout basement. Just lock up the walkout basement and bring in 30 truckloads of dirt and solve that problem. You know, so there's options to people, but you explain basically the options. You know, you've heard them. You know, and if you happen to be the person that doesn't like an extra layer of regulation, then you say, well, it's probably not a good thing. I don't like that. But if you're sitting there saying, this is an opportunity for some people to get flood insurance that don't have it now, it doesn't add that much extra work. It does add something, I will admit that, but change your zoning ordinance and that adds extra work. I mean, it's just, we're in the role of government and some things you just have to do. Now, this is optional, obviously. How many properties?
Only about five.
About five?
Yeah.
So it's not going to add a whole lot of work.
And that's according to the DNR. I had estimated there'd be 5 to 10, but the DNR said there's five.
And of those five, we have no idea how many of them have a active mortgage that they owe on that would be required.
Right. So. Yep, it's only when they have a loan.
Okay.
So, you know, I've been there. I've worked with it before, and you get the maps out, and you look at them, and you go like, well, yeah, but my property was filled in back in 52, and it doesn't look like that now. Okay. Submit the paperwork. And I've seen it happen where a developer came in, and he was right, and he got to build his condos down by the river because he was actually 2 feet above. So.
I've been involved in a couple of floods in Valley City, and the homes that we had required to be built up and have all the proper mechanicals in the proper places, they were islands in the flood plain area, which is right now, we have a flood zone, a flood way also, had a flood way. But one of them was the banker, and he came in and thanked me afterwards, because, you know, one thing that a lot of people don't realize is when there's a flood, you're totally out of control. I mean, these waters rise and rise and rise, and I don't care if you sandbag or not, there's a limit to it. And at some point, they just keep coming and coming, and it's very disempowering. So, you know, his property is brand new, perfectly safe, and a number of the homes around them had to be destroyed because of the molds that just infiltrate the entire house, and especially the mechanical systems, the ductwork. So it's impossible to clean that stuff. So.
Any other questions? So we got a few options. Choose not to participate. Move it forward for public hearing to the Planning Commission. Or delay it.
I feel we have one option, that is to move it forward. That's a motion.
Second.
So that motion is to move it to the Planning Commission.
Yes.
So, and then it'll come back to us.
Correct.
Have they discussed it at all?
They have not. We just submitted it today in hopes that you're going to.
Okay. We have a motion on the table to move it to the Planning Commission for a public hearing. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? That carries.
Great.
Move
Thank
it
you.
Forward.
All right. Well, it's been a long road, so I'm glad.
All right, next is updates.
Yes. Okay, so I assume you all received the updates I submit to the city administrator. The department, and I haven't done this before, so I'll just kind of talk like, you know, I've been here 3 months.
Like you've been here 3 years.
3 years. I'll talk like I've been here 3 years, yeah. You know, the department is pretty fantastic. I mean, we do an awful lot of work. You know, we've got about $45 million worth of projects flowing through our department right now. And that's brought in about $40,000 in permit fee revenues. That's pretty awesome. And Sarah has been bringing in lots of grants, really working hard and diligently to energize downtown and the rest of the community to get positive attitudes and positive ideas about what can be done with the streets, the streetscape, the lighting, all sorts of stuff. And you know, she's been absolutely fantastic. She's also been diving into TIF with Herzog and learning the ropes with TIF with Robert Scott. Probably the person that has the biggest headaches is Jason, because he does a lot of the property maintenance citations, and also the rent permit renewals. And so his frustrations are very much what, for instance, V2040's frustrations, or a lot of other people's frustrations are, about the process taking so long and for people having way too many chances. But we want to revisit the ordinance and see if there's some way we can maybe shorten it, but still have the initial introductory phase where we approach the folks, try to get them to comply on a verbal, do a second, and then cite them. That's sort of the general kind of third strike, you know, then we cite them. Then after that, we really like to try to get the process shortened up so that we can get it moved to the judge if necessary, which probably means increasing the penalties and shortening the timelines and getting the judge on board before we do it, so that when they do reach him, he doesn't throw it out and say this is heavy-handed and wrong, you know.
That's the hard part, getting the judge,
right?
The judges
right.
to agree.
So. Right. So he's been working very hard at citing a lot of the blighted properties. One of the issues is we have a lot of them. And it's really, frankly, far more than one person can do. But he's been trying to create a pipeline and address them as he can. And you know, we get emails and calls every week, and so, you know, neighbors are impatient. They call back. They say, "Well, nothing's changed." Well, you know, they have 7 days to business days to comply and that sort of thing. So, we're also trying not to be weaponized against people's neighbors. We want to, you know, if somebody calls, we look at the property that has been called. We also look at the property of the person who called. You know, if you're living in a glass house, you shouldn't throw stones. We also drive around the block, so we want to make sure that we just don't go to that one individual. We kind of check the area a little bit and see if there's any other compliance issues before we go back to the office. So they're not picked on, and we're not weaponized against the people. So those are just some of the kind of things we've been trying to do with Jason, to trying to soften things up a little bit, but also get to the point. You know, the garage teardown is probably one of the biggest examples. That's been going on for over a year, chasing that one and trying to get it demolished. And finally, it's going to court to get a judgment.
Why did that take so long?
You know, I don't know the entire history of it, but I know the recent history is we've gone back to them so many times on a personal level and finally cited them when I came on board. And then it had to go through like a 30-day. That one particularly had to go through a 30-day for some reason. And then once it got cited, I had to go through another long period of time before it could finally be taken to the judge. So that citation sheet's pretty old. But anyway. And then we have a lot of training. Building inspectors are well behind on their training. And so we're trying to make sure that they can actually get their hours in. I'm hopefully going to put in for a training budget increase. And you know, because you know, Sarah has a lot of training in terms of her getting her planning certification. We luckily got Tom's state designation, but we also, for succession purposes, want to get Jason, our inspector, building official certified, so that when Tom does retire in the next few years, we can have a smooth transition and get him designated too at the same time. So training is a real big important thing, another big important thing that we've been doing. And Jason's all hog wild and ready to go. He's already started the class. And that's kind of where we're at. Okay. A lot of foundational stuff.
So how about projects like Arby's? When are they going to be done? And Target? And
sure, Arby's and actually Kentucky Fried Chicken even is doing a renovation. They're expected to be done probably in the next 3 months.
Kentucky Fried Chicken? Arby's?
Arby's. Kentucky Fried Chicken's just starting.
Oh.
Yeah. Kohl's is going to open up probably in late September.
Okay.
Yeah. They're trying, maybe October. You know, they want to get in just before the holiday season. Mm-hmm. We have, I mean, just to rattle off a few of the big ones, you know, we have Jennie-O as a $465,000 trailer shed footing going up. We got Kohl's, which is $2.4 million. We have Ziegler Cat, which is a $14.6 million deal. Actually, Ziegler Cat is actually two parts. They have a 14.6 for the structures and another $800,000 just for the all the utilities that they're bringing in. So it's really about a $15 million deal. Verizon is doing a $150,000 renovation.
In the Candy Mall, that building? Or?
Yep.
Yeah, it looked like something.
And we've got Jake's Pizza. Everybody seems to be asking about Jake's Pizza and Kohl's.
That Jake's is a big topic. They have a date?
They are looking probably in the next 30 to 60 days. They want to try to do it pretty quick. So.
All right.
That's $60,000. So. Yeah.
That's the one that I get the most calls about.
Yep. I think they just finished their new roof.
Good.
So. Let's see. State of Minnesota is doing a $9 million, 16-bed psychiatric addition. So we've got, you know, many tens of millions of dollars coming into the city, which is pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's very good. Yeah. Any other questions?
Yeah.
Sean?
I would just say, you know, when you come in with a new set of eyes, maybe do an examination of a lot of the ordinances that cover some of the things that you deal with. If there's anything that you think we should look at to maybe change that could make it easier or streamline or caught up to date,
right?
Please start that process as well.
Thank you very much. We'd actually like to maybe do more informal, where we kind of vet some of these ideas so they're not necessarily on the table for moving immediately to council. But to get a sense of whether we're kind of heading in the right direction on some of these things, so it might be informational. Would that be okay?
That's fine.
Yeah. Good. We also have some housing initiatives that we want to pursue, but we can't really do that until we do this. We're also going to be we're doing a lot of foundational stuff, so we want to do a data mining effort where, for instance, we just purchased a $1,500 GIS patch with engineering, so we paid $750 and they paid $750. And so we want to create probably 30, 40 map layers on GIS, which will cover, you know, soup to nuts, from demographics, racial profile of the city, crime profile, economic income profiles, what properties are rental, home-owned, multifamily, which ones are condo, co-op, rental, multifamily, which ones are single-family homes, owned, rented, that sort of thing. So that we can have this broad picture of the context, and then we want to let that inform the revision of the comprehensive plan and some proposals for housing to try to do a more inclusive and less exclusive housing ordinance. City of Minneapolis is in a lot of hot water right now over some things that they're trying to do. They're trying to make things so that you don't have middle income multifamily, wealthy multifamily, and poor multifamily. You don't have, everything's not segregated by building. They're trying to make it so that it's mixed. And that's the kind of direction I would like to be able to propose once we kind of have more concrete ideas and some narrative. But that's kind of another path we're going with the housing.
Well, that's invaluable beyond housing. That's going to inform a lot of decisions.
Right.
Make a data decision. So I think that's a great idea.
So. Jenny?
So who do we all have on staff that has the ability to work that software?
You know, it's just Sarah. So I'm hoping that we can maybe do it. We did a contract with Mid-Minnesota the last time, 10 years ago, when we did the comprehensive plan. I'm hoping that we can grab the low-hanging fruits ourselves, Sarah can, and get those downloaded into map layers. But the harder data, I'm hoping we can use Mid-Minnesota to enhance her efforts and magnify Sarah, so to speak, so that we can maybe get all these other map layers established and then use them for the comprehensive plan like before. But one of their complaints was that the comprehensive plan kind of came from down high, that it did not have a lot of data from the city. It was more of a, this is kind of what we want to do kind of a thing. And so what we want to do is we want to come from the bottom up. We want it to be a fact-based, data-based plan. But more importantly, at the end of the comprehensive plan, we want it to have an action plan so that we can actually start maybe bringing some of these things into people's, into staff's job descriptions. Mm-hmm. So that's carried out in their daily routine. And so it doesn't become a paperweight.
So do the different maps exist right now, or do they have to be created to put into GIS? Because that's a whole different ballgame.
Right. The basic map exists in GIS, but the layer will have to be created. Yeah, they don't exist. It's a big job.
That's a lot of work.
Yeah. I think once you've kind of got a generic layer, though, I think we can reuse that layer over again and to put on our other, you know, demographic layers on top of that as an overlay. So I think we just got to create this one template layer and we should be able to do the rest. So pretty easily, I hope.
Do you get any college interns or anything?
That's another thing we're discussing is bringing in an intern, not just for GIS, but to help Jason, maybe in the springtime, doing some property maintenance citations, just to get a batch pipeline kind of established every season. So
don't they have to be licensed then?
No. Not for just driving down the streets and inventorying properties and bringing back photographs and saying, here, this is kind of splattering on the wall. Here's what we got. Let's pick the, you know, top 40 offenders. That sort of thing. I think we can just say intern can do that. He's not going to go on property or go on houses or anything.
Oh, just drive. Yeah,
just drive. Right.
Any other questions? Well, thanks for the info.
Thanks.
And we're easy to work with, so you got some recommendations.
You are. Thank you.
Anything else? Any old business? Okay, we're adjourned.
Thank you.
I participated.